So good news or bad news? Yes. I'd love to have a few minutes to check in with you about what you're noticing so far. Anything about the instructions. As you may have noticed, the use of a primary anchor, an initial way of collecting, connecting, and sustaining. And one was the sense of the whole body sitting, and sometimes that one works best by combining a sense of the whole body sitting and then some touch point. So there's a kind of rhythm, sitting and touching, or just sitting. I offered also the hands, the touch of the hands, either touching each other, whatever that felt sense of the hands, whatever they're touching. And then the usual, which is the body's experience of its own breathing. And I say that because it's not an egoic thing. It's not a doer thing. It's the body breathes according to its needs. And we simply, just awareness, takes that experience as an object. And just directs the attention to the feeling of the body breathing. And I offered three general options for mindfulness of breathing, which is the whole body breathing, which I think you just had Tan Jeff here in a previous retreat, teaches a full whole body breath, finding a comfortable breath, that's a sense of inflation, deflation, a little expanding and contracting. And then talked about the rising and falling, and centered either on the chest or the belly. That's some people, that's just easy to feel the gentle expansion and contraction of the body that way. And then the feeling of the air, the effect of the air passing the nostrils or upper lip, the brushing feeling or a change of temperature, just in and out. So I offer different options because for some people the breath is a very contentious object. They either can't feel it or it's associated with not being able to breathe or something. And so it really doesn't matter as long as the mind is, attention is in the same location as the body and the harmony that comes from that. I just wanted to clarify that a little bit and open it to any questions that you have, and then any questions you have about the walking. One of the things I didn't say about walking, maybe I've said it before when I was here, that for me, the walking, not only is it an equal opportunity, mindfulness equal in to the sitting, for me, that is the place in my intensive practice where I had many, 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 many more meditative insights during walking than sitting. And we tend to somehow idealize the sitting, think of it as a more privileged, special experience, and treat the walking a little bit like the break or the just less important. But really, it is equal opportunity, the same power of mind. That's same qualities of mind are being generated, are being reawakened, this incredible observing power that comes from gathering and sustaining. And then there's so many fruits to just those two qualities developing in whatever it is we're paying attention to. And in that vein, we also expand beyond just the formal periods of sitting and walking. We try to bring that same quality of what's called vitaka and vichara, gathering and sustaining, to the in-between periods, and the transition periods, and the eating we'll do at lunch, etc. So curious about any comments, questions about the sitting instructions, walking, or anything else you're noticing, or anything that's been set up to this point. Just way to connect with you, and it's likely that your comment or question will be of some benefit to someone else. So it's part of our practice of generosity, part of our sangha. So, no pressure though. Please, thank you.
Yes. And I'm
Well, thoughts, if they're noticed, are not distractions. So sometimes insights will be, there will be an aha, an intuition that may be a full body experience, but it will eventually express itself in some kind of narrative as well. And that's, if that's noticed, sometimes that's the way it's integrated. In fact, in phenomenology, you know, the whole study of what experience is, they have a word called experiaction. It's the way our mind translates experience into language, and that's part of it in a way. So that may be one of the things that gets noticed. So try not to treat thoughts as a distraction when they're noticed, but just thoughts. Thoughts are to our door of perception called mind, as a sound is to the ear. It's just it's the problem isn't the fact that we think, it's that we tend to get lost, that we tend to dream, and that's just the function of mindfulness not showing up to notice them. So just that. As far as, so your question is about what are those insights? Don't you want to hear my whole meditative story?
But yeah, just more so, I always kind of was fuzzy on the distinguishment between, you know, how much should you think about the thought, how much should you be following a thought in meditation. But
no, we don't really follow a thought. Thoughts will come, and ideally they're noticed. And then once they're noticed, they tend to show their ephemeral nature. They kind of evaporate. So we don't intentionally extend them. But there may be this kind of impulse to ponder something, and no matter how much mindfulness, there may be this kind of compelling urge. That happens sometimes, and sometimes through that little spontaneous reflection, there is some value to that. But in general, not. But sometimes insights just come as kind of, it's just like a picture or a release or an aha. It's an intuition. It's generally prior to a narrative. Yeah. But not too many insights. Not too many wordless insights are not followed by some kind of reflection. We want to really be easy about the reflective mind as well. It's just part of our mind stream. It's a miracle. We tend to get this negative, not you, but meditators tend to have this slightly aversive relationship to the thinking mind. And then, not the problem, please. Thoughts often come, there's often a physical corollary to thoughts. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's, I think, for you to discover that. Definitely emotions are the body's experience usually related to thought, either not always a word thought, but an image or an association. There's emotions are often the body's experience of thoughts. And often the body's experience of thoughts can sometimes, the feelings will often generate thoughts, and the thoughts will generate feelings. So there's an interrelationship, no doubt. But some thoughts are just kind of mind chatter, and they don't really leave any residue. And yet, the way that we experience, you know, especially thoughts that are associated with a pleasant feeling, pleasant thoughts, then often we feel that pleasantness through the body. It's really hard to find a dividing line. Do you want to say more about your question? Or is it just more of a... Oh, I've never heard that. That's an interesting contemplation. Cool. Any other questions, comments about working with, please. Pleased that I was talking about the hands as a focus.
That's right. Because for me, it's a much steadier focus.
Steadier focus.
Breathing often, the rhythmic part of the breathing, often breathing leads me into some stupor.
Breathing can lead into stupor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the hands is a much steadier place.
Yeah, it's steady. It can be steadier. And sometimes the waves of the breath, though, the noticing its changing nature, all the insights that one would need to understand the nature of reality can be experienced in that, and also can develop a kind of flexibility of mind to be able to sustain mindfulness through changing conditions. But I think at first, as we settle in, I think it really is good to have a kind of steadying experience. Yeah, and that mimics the immovability of awareness. But we won't talk about that too much now. Please.
Sort of along the line of thought, insight, mindfulness, analysis, if you want.
Insights, mindfulness, analysis.
And discernment.
Discernment.
How is it connected? Like, I think I get sometimes confused between mindfulness and analysis of my process.
Well, we don't do any analysis of our process, meditative awareness. We basically bring what's called sati sampajanya, bare attention, just very childlike, open. Just, we only know six things, really, initially. Just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. So there's that bare attention, and then there's another quality that goes with that. When there's attention, it's the intelligent part of it. It's clear comprehension. It's called sampajanya, or different people pronounce it differently. So it's very non-analytic. It's just knowing what's present. And so we're not really, it's not asking why at all. Sometimes because of the intimacy of that, the non-judgmental, non-interfering quality of that kind of bare attention with clear comprehension, there is some kind of clear perception of what's being experienced. And with that comes a kind of flash of insight, comes a reflection or a feeling of some kind of understanding. But it didn't come from analyzing. It came from being free of our usual interpretations and analysis and asking the questions why, much more because we sense the what in something. The byproduct of that kind of careful, bare attention with clear comprehension, the byproduct is we get all kinds of insights, and they may even be psychological insights. You can actually just understand the sequence of how something happened just by being there. And so the why gets answered not because of you thought about it, not because you were problem solving, but just because there was the intelligence of awareness present. So, oh, good. Yeah, we are excessively dominated by rational mind, which needs for its fuel, it needs to be problem solving, and of course our identity then gets built around solving a problem, that we are a problem to be solved. Any of you ever feel that way? We never find that in real time, though. We never find that. We only find that in the historical version of ourselves. That it's a problem to be solved. We don't find it in present time. What do you find in present time, the non-historical version of yourself?
Curiosity.
What else?
Stillness.
Awareness. Please.
I'm just
seeing like arising, and some of the things that come through my mind, I have no idea where they're coming from, but they're just kind of like arising, and then I'm watching, and then they're gone. And then I get this little lull where there's like, oh, here I am. And then another one sort of starts coming up. So I'm just curious, like the more you meditate, the more of the still pieces come, or does the mind just continually work like that? Like, it's almost like parallel, like it's parallel.
Like a parallel universe to the embodied experience is this kind of mind stream. Of course, you would, you'll, yeah.
My body all of a sudden goes, oh yeah, remember my hands are connected to my spine, and then I'll be back in my body, but it's so brief, and then boom, my mind goes again.
Well, if you're not alone, just so you know, to normalize this, you're not alone in being, like I said before, we tend to be dominated by our thinking mind and our that particular door of perception, mind, and we tend to be very disembodied. Our life is often about, we're caught in a trance of time, coming from the past, on our way somewhere, figuring things out, working things out, mapping things out, having things relate to one another, and often just the simple experience of being embodied and actually loving it, finding, like Tan Jeff talks about finding a comfortable breath and really feeling it, feeling your arms and loving it, you know, just having this incredible instrument of perception be such an enemy in a way. And of course, if you're born, it's subject to lots of difficult experiences, and that's maybe one of the reasons we tend to become disembodied is we haven't learned how to accommodate the unpleasant flavors. But we're just all part of, we live in a cult of rational mind, and it's not to, and we're all affected by a world that's all about busy and becoming. I even brought with me today, it just explains a little bit why you're only occasionally we feel our body. This is something I've read at almost every retreat since the last century. It's from Amy Krauss Rosenthal, a wonderful editorialist who passed away at a very young age, unfortunately. And she entitled this Sweet Nothing. How've you been? Busy. How's work? Busy. How was your week? Good. Busy. You name the question, busy's the answer. Yes, yes, I know we're all terribly busy and doing terribly important things, but I think more often than not, busy is simply the most acceptable knee-jerk response. Certainly there are more interesting, more original, more accurate ways to answer the question, how are you? I'm hungry for a burrito. I'm envious of my best friend. I'm frustrated by everything that's broken in my home. I'm itchy. Yet, busy stands alone as the easiest way of summarizing all that you do and all that you are. I'm busy is the short way of saying, implying my time is filled, my phone does not stop ringing, and you therefore should think well of me. How quaint is that? My phone does not stop ringing. Nobody uses the phone anymore. Texting. Anyway, my time is filled, my phone does not stop ringing, and you therefore should think well of me. Have people always been this busy? Did cavemen think they were busy too? This week is crazy. I've got about 10 caves to draw on. Can I meet you by the fire next week? I have a hunch that there's a direct correlation between the advent of coffee bars and the increase of busyness. Look at us. We're pros now at hailing taxis, making Xeroxes. Can you believe it? Does that company even exist anymore? carpooling, performing surgery with a to-go cup in hand. We're skittering about like hyperactive gerbils, high not just on caffeine, but on caffeine's luscious byproduct, productivity, the joy of doing, accomplishing, crossing off. As kids, our stock answer to almost every question, what did you do at school today? What's new? It's nothing. In our country's history, there have been exactly 7 kids who responded with a statement other than nothing. Then somewhere on the way to adulthood, we each took a 180-degree turn. We cashed in our nothing for busy. I'm starting to think that, like youth, the word nothing is wasted on the young. Maybe we should try to reintroduce it into our grown-up vernacular. Nothing. I say it a few times. I can feel myself becoming quiet, decaffeinated, meditative, nothing. Now I'm picturing emptiness, a white blanket, a couple of ducks gliding on a still pond. Nothing, nothing. How did we get so far away from it? Isn't it amazing we're not far away from it? It's nearer than our breath, but it's just neglected. And there's often in meditators, there will be a point where the mind will, one of the doubts that comes based on this kind of cultural trance is, I got things to do. Or I'm bored, or I should be, or this is selfish. You know, all the different flavors of needing to prop up, defend, protect, build up the identity, which is so much based on that productivity, doing, accomplishing. There's so many problems in the world. So, anyway, having said that, I have no idea why we're so disembodied, but I have a hunch, or it's not personal. It's a part of our collective condition. Beauty is you can really learn to actually feel that non-historical sense of yourself, and once you really get to know it, you'll see you're not as bad as people say. No, really, you're not as bad as you say.
Albert, I think that when you say that, it's really important when any teacher says that, because I know for me, it's like it sort of jolts me or moves me out of the trance of what that is that I'm doing, of everything that you just said. It's a trance state.
It is. Pleasure. Well, it's also a reminder that why no one does practice alone very well, why it's so important to have that valuing of the immediate felt sense be mirrored by others, and that's why we practice with a group, and that's why the Sangha is equal to the Buddha and the Dharma, is because we tend to get that mirroring when we practice together. And we tend to, with it, disembodiment comes individualism, becomes isolation, becomes feeling, when we're spinning in our internal world, like that we are cut off from the flow of life, that we're caught up in separateness, and then we do get into our own, it's all about me and mine, a kind of narcissistic indulgence. And we forget that we don't exist alone apart from each other. And so Sangha really brings alive that sense of here we are, and it's precious. There's nothing more precious. And the only way to make the body and present I'll just say it this. We want to make being present so interesting and compelling that it begins to diminish the desire to be somewhere else. Whereas if the more disembodied I get, the less comfortable I am being present, and the more I want to be somewhere else. So we have to break that trance and have real time become the only time there really is, become more compelling than the imagined past or future. So, and generally, that's why having our mind and body come into harmony, the present does become so interesting that I don't really want to be anywhere else. I think that's really a fruit of practice. I don't want to be anywhere else. I remember when I was 21 years old, maybe I've told this story here. I had done some insight meditation practice. Maybe it was 20, I don't remember. It was after my first retreat. I went to visit my cousin in Central America. Now when I think about it, what a privilege to be able to travel freely like that. I took it for granted in those days, but I was staying on this little coffee farm, and they use hammocks a lot in Costa Rica, and they're beautiful woven hammocks. And I was lying in a hammock one day, and I had one of those insights. And it was an aha that this is the first moment I could remember in my 22 years. You know, that's a long time, even though I'm a young person at that point. But it was the first time that I didn't want to be somewhere else. And that became a kind of seed. Just to see how often mind is jumping ahead or jumping back, jumping ahead, jumping back. How much? And that actually has eased a lot. Except when I'm at airports. No, I'm just kidding. No, airports are wonderful. Except I've had my last two flights, two trips to Canada have been really unpleasant, though. Edmonton last month, I woke up to find out that they had canceled my outbound flight with no follow-up. I had to do all the labor. So I got there literally 5 minutes before the retreat started, through a very roundabout way. And then I woke up on the morning of the end of the retreat, and I was informed that they canceled my return flight. And without it providing any backup support. And when I arrived at the airport at the end of the retreat, I still didn't have a flight. And I met a saint, though, who changed the coding on my ticket and got me on a flight. But if it wasn't for that angel, I could still be in Edmonton. And then yesterday I woke up to find out my flight was delayed, and then one thing led to another, and I ended up on the third or fourth different flight. But otherwise, airports are interesting. Any other questions before we do a little stroll and then a short sitting? About the working with the breath, working with the body, working with walking. Okay, thanks for your questions. Let's have a 15-minute walking period, then we'll have one more. Are you okay to have another sitting before lunch? Okay, so we'll sit again at, I have 5 minutes after. So we'll sit again at 20 minutes after, or the gong will go off at 20 after. We'll sit at 25 after until whenever. But so 15 minutes of walking and then the gong. And if anyone wants to check in, please feel free to come forward.